31st, 2025, at the Revolutionary Square in Havana, Cuba. An estimated 600,000 people participated in Havana alone, with estimates of 5 million throughout the mighty socialist Caribbean pit stop. It started around dawn as people gathered from faraway locations, some riding in buses that were stacked up bumper to bumper in the nearby residential streets, and then walked a hefty distance to join in the parade. Far bigger than any May Day protest in the streets of Winnipeg or any other city in Canada, this event was more like a sporting victory than a demand for change. The slogan for the event this year was, "Por Cuba, juntos creamos." For Cuba, together we create. The Cuban people have been through so much over the last 60 plus years, with intense periods of hardship, especially over the last decade. The bulk of this hardship, I suspect, is due to the blockade, but there is a disturbing trend developing, at least as far back as the Obama administration, that elements of the Cuban society are succumbing to American pressure and are serving roles, willingly or not, against the very principles of the revolution. If that is the case, how does the resistance in the streets react to the reality of the enemy within, so to speak? And has the revolutionary fight weakened with the death of the legendary Fidel Castro? That concept will be the subscript to the discussion in a special episode of this program. Hello, everyone. My name is Michael Welch, and you are listening to the Global Research News Hour, a show funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, the Innu, the Ojibwe, the Dene, and the Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The program seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our shows are available to partner radio stations across Canada and the United States, and available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. One of the evident signs the Cuban people may be succumbing to the U.S. pressure in the post-Castro years is the tendency of many young Cubans to leave Cuba for positions in America. This is likely hampering the development of Cuba. When I was last in Havana in December, I had a chat with Iran, the official of the North American division of the Cuban Institute of Friendship with the People, or ECAP. I asked him about the situation that saw even a fellow ECAP member leave for pastures abroad.
I spoke to one of your fellow ECAP members. I mean, he ended up leaving, and he wasn't necessarily putting down what he was doing, but he got an opportunity to work for some organization in the United States, and he felt compelled to, like, reduce his involvement in ECAP, for example. And I know that there are a lot of people leaving Cuba to, you know, young people going in these sorts of foreign ventures. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit, if not about that, but about, in general, what kind of carrots are being offered to the Cuban people that might work with the stick to motivate changes within the country.
I mean, the way I see it,
okay,
we already had two examples of that. Hmm. So when it comes to stick and the carrot, stick was all we had up to the last 2 years of Obama's second term. Now, then they decided to change the approach, right? So they reopened the embassies, they reestablished bilateral relationships, they reopened or enlarged consulate services. They started to accomplish the agreements about visa granting to go to the U.S. either as a visitor or permanently, right? They allowed U.S. citizens to do tourism in Cuba, even though it was still under certain categories you need to apply to, but hey, You can go to the beach, you can go to the hotels, you can go to all places, right? And not having it to hide it, but you can, you could do it as a U.S. citizen publicly, you know, like, and expect no retaliation for it. So in those moments, I mean, he even gave a speech at the one of our classrooms in the Havana University, where he invited the Cuban people to, hey, let's forget about the past. Let's start from the scratch. So that's paraphrasing, but it's pretty much the essence of the almost an hour speech he gave there. And that's the moment of the carrot part. So they flexed a little bit here and there. And the life in Cuba prospered, like, very, very rapidly, you know, because it was, you know, money flowing into our economy, like, constantly. I mean, two cruise ships arrived twice a week or once a week, bringing U.S. tourists, you know, that used to dock in Havana Harbor, but then they visited like three or four more spots along the island. So it was like 6,000 people spending money, you know? And the U.S. tourist is like, you know, the guy who actually, hey, let's pay for all this. We're taking this, you know? This is ours right now. It's very, a very aggressive kind of tourism, but they bring a lot of money wherever they go. So it was a prosper moment for, you know, private entrepreneurs. I mean, from the person who sells paintings or small souvenirs to the ones who own restaurants or cafeterias or other kinds of businesses. I don't know, a gym or whatever place these tourists visit, you know. And that same money enter into our state economy through the taxes that private entrepreneurs pay to the state, as in every other country in the world, right? And so it was a prosperous moment for everybody, because then the state had also more money to provide services like healthcare, education, that are completely free in Cuba, you know? So it was a good time for everybody. But we were aware that the approach was, hey, let's try to change the method, right? Because what we have been doing these past 60 years hasn't worked, which is, hey, we need to overthrow the revolution, the revolutionary government, the what they call a dictatorship, communist dictatorship. So, and Obama, when explaining what was gonna happen before doing all the things they did, explicitly said it. So we have been acting this way for 60 years. We need to change the approach. That's what they did. So the intentions were the same, right? But we were up for the challenge, you know? So what? A lot of you as citizens coming here, probably the idea of the U.S. government is, hey, the more people we send, the more chances there are for Cubans to change their mindset, you know, about what life really should be. But the fact is that this many U.S. citizens coming, most of them for the first time to Cuba, out of curiosity, because it was the forbidden fruit, right? The effect was quite the opposite. So people came down here and were like, hey, this is not what we have been told it was, you know? So we have been lied to, and we're discovering a whole different story. So the feedback they brought back to the United States was like, hey, there's a good thing going on down there, you know? So probably that's also why they, I mean, Trump decided to, you know, shut it down, you know? And when it comes to, you know, people fleeing to the U.S. or any other country because of, or trying to migrate because of the difficult situation in Cuba, you have to look at the history of Cuban migration, mostly to the U.S. because it is a very close place, right? That didn't start with the Cuban Revolution. So it's, first of all, it's not a matter of, hey, there's a revolution, people are fleeing. No. We Cubans are islanders, right? Yeah. So it's within our DNA wanting to know what's beyond the sea. That's first, right? And people have migrated to U.S. or other places from Cuba since forever for different reasons, in different historical moments, right? Now, when the revolution begins, the first one to flee were the ones who were escaping the revolutionary process for different reasons, right? Maybe because they were rich people and just wanted to go and spend a week in Miami, thinking probably that Fidel and his comrades wouldn't last more than a week, or trying to wait and see if he was a new kind of dictator that would keep doing the same as Batista so they could come back and still, you know, retake their lives. But also those who were part of the police, part of the army, people who had committed crimes, torture, all the people, those were the ones who fled first, right, when the revolution tried. And of course, you might say that's a political kind of migration. But since the years passed, and mostly after the hard crisis that started in the early 90s, I would say that the main reason for people to flee Cuba is the hard situation, economically speaking, that exists, and the different moments of crisis we have had. But that has many angles, right? So because you have a U.S., okay, that it's the main obstacle. I mean, it's not that we don't have our own issues to solve, right? But the main obstacle for the development of Cuba economically and in other areas is the U.S. blockade, right? So that's very important to highlight. And that's the main reason for the different crises we have had all along these years. So that's first. You have a difficult situation that you create in Cuba as, you know, the U.S., right? Then you have these massive campaigns to attract people and sell the idea that, hey, you live in a place that's not going to prosper because it's not, that system doesn't work. But here, we have everything you need because capitalism is best, right? So we have everything at low prices. You can come here and get everything you need. That's second. Then, since the very early years of the, I mean, since the 60s, you have the Cuban Adjustment Law, which is only addressed to Cuban migrants into the United States, which gives them the privilege of being able to access residency after 1 year and 1 day of being in the United States, which is different for other migrants who sometimes spend 20 years living in the States without legal status, right?
Okay.
And fearing deportation. It's not that for the Cubans. So you as a Cuban, you get there, right? You apply for the Cuban Adjustment Law. You claim being a political refugee, and that's it. After 1 year and 1 day, you get residential status that gives you the opportunity to access healthcare, work permits, you know, everything to start a living. And then when you have, when you put all that into place, it's very hard not to, you know, think as a person. So, hey, here what I have is scarcity. There, even though I might know it's all manipulations, but actually I have an opportunity because I have this act that gives me this privilege, and then I can live easily. It's not like I'm going to migrate to some place where I will have to, you know, I would be treated like dirt or anything. It's right. Different. Now, the thing is also that since we Cubans have been migrating to the United States for many, many years, even before the revolution and afterwards, where people have more family and a wider support network is precisely in the United States. That's why the Cuban community abroad, the larger one, is the one that lives in the States. Out of the 4 million Cubans that live abroad, or Cuban descendants that live abroad, half of that is in the United States. Because it's very close, and we have a migration history with the U.S. like that dates from long ago. And that serves also the purpose of the U.S. government to say, to keep the narrative of a bloody and repressive dictatorship. So people are so afraid there and so desperate to escape communism that they will get on a raft and sail, or they would get to the jungle in Central America and walk all the way, you know. So it has many angles. But the real fact is that it affects Cuba a lot. Because, I mean, let's face it, most of people who migrate are young people. In their 20s, in their 30s, in their early 40s. So in plain reproductive ages and in plain capacity, working capacity ages, right? So you get a professional that you spent, even though you didn't charge his or her family for it, but you spent as a government or as a state, you spent a lot of money to train. So once that person is trained, they decide to migrate. So you lose that labor force, you lose that trained professional. That's for starters. But then you are losing a young person in a population that is already aged for other factors. Then you lose young people in reproductive ages, which makes it harder to, repopulate the country. So it ages even faster, right? And then if people are too old, they won't be able to work. It's a bigger issue for the economy, economic development. So it's multi-factor issue, you know, this of migration. But what gives you an idea of how different it could be is, for instance, this same moment of the Obama approachment with Cuba, right? So during that time when consulate services widened up, and the U.S. started to actually fulfilling the agreements on legal migration to the U.S., they started to grant 5 years visa to Cubans going there. And the people who actually migrated reduced enormously. Because those who migrate there to stay were the ones who already had it planned because they had a close family, or because they have been planning and go live there for many years already. But most of the people with these 5 year visa, what they did is that they went to the U.S., they spent time with family, probably they got a side job, they could make some money out of it, you know, and then they came back. And with that little money they made, it was a good amount of money here because of the exchange rate. So people went there, spent 6 months, then 6 months here, and so on. A few people actually stayed, you know. Now, when you don't have that possibility, it's take it or leave it, stay or go. Well, people sometimes, of course, they decide to, hey, let's just, you know, go there.
While I was traveling through Cuba last December, I stayed in Santa Clara and resided for a couple of days in a bed and breakfast owned by Michael Espinoza, the owner of a small business in Cuba. He also had background in psychology, and unlike most of the people I met during my time with the Calixto Garcia Brigade, had no objection to expressing his critical views of the Cuban government. He spoke of protests and poverty affecting Cuba under the current one-party state watch. Here is a little of what he had to say about the current state of the country and the factors that led to it.
After the death of President Chavez, there was a situation of political crisis in Venezuela itself, and this political crisis had a repercussion in Cuba on the economic level. That is, the flow of wealth that was sent from Venezuela to Cuba has decreased significantly, especially in oil. It has also happened that Cuba, from the establishment of trade and diplomatic relations with the United States in 2014 with Obama, the Cuban government decided to make multi-million dollar investment in the real estate sector, that is, to build many hotels. Thinking that there would be a great flow of tourism from North America, that is, from the United States to Cuba, which began to happen until 2016-2017, when President Donald Trump became president. And Trump eliminated certain economic measures that had been implemented with the Obama administration regarding Cuba. The flow of North American tourism to Cuba decreased significantly, but the government decided to continue investing in hotels. That is, the investment of hotels in Cuba did not decrease at all. There are statistics in the main office of the Statistics Office of Cuba that in the period from 2017 to 2021, the Cuban state invested 34% more money in the budget of the nation in real estate and tourism, that in health, agriculture, housing and construction together.
Fue muy superior la inversión en el turismo con respecto a estos otros sectores que son más importantes.
There is investment of tourism was much higher compared to these other sectors, which are more important. Now, the process of the crisis due to the COVID pandemic in Cuba arrived, and the Cuban government decided not to stop investing in tourism. That is, they kept investing remarkably. There was a circumstance in the year 2021, in the month of July, where there were massive protests in Cuba because there was a real economic crisis in Cuba, but also a crisis of governability. Because of the crisis of the pandemic itself, when the borders were closed, there were practically no ways to import food. So the Cuban government kept investing in hotels. Of course, as there was no investment in agriculture, food shortage began to appear. That is, there was not enough food to eat, to buy, and these protests occurred. But also the protests of July 11th were the concentration of many years of ideological repression. There is a single party has been governing Cuba since 1959 without allowing opposition groups, eliminating the opponents, forcing them to suffer many years in prison, forcing them to emigrate, for example. And then the opposition was completely eliminated. What happened on July 11th and 12th? There were massive protests. There was a great repression by the government. That is, they took the light troops from the army and the police to the streets to confront the people. There are many images that were collected of this confrontation between these light troops against the people. After that situation, there were approximately 6,000 detainees, of which certain of which a certain number of people were released until they were left in approximately 1,000 political prisoners. The figure varies. There are people who say there are over 900, other people who say that there are 1,100 political prisoners. There are in that range. The reality is that these political prisoners, the vast majority of them, did not commit any kind of constitutional crime because of in Cuba, in the Cuban Constitution approved 2019, it appears that you have the right to peaceful demonstration. But the Cuban government has said that as long as the government itself does not pass a specific law for this type of demonstration, it remains unconstitutional. Many people do not accept it if you, in the Constitution, approved by the people, you said that it is possible to have a peaceful demonstration. Why do you, as a government, declare that it's unconstitutional? Many people contradict this type of measure and realize that the government did not have the best intentions for the Cuba, for the people of Cuba to function as a democracy. And it established a period of real repression for these political prisoners and for those people who made public statements, whether on social networks or in public spaces, such as the streets, parks, avenues, etc. So what has happened at this time? Cuba is, as I see it, under a system of implicit or silent repression, as we say, where we know that if you want to denounce the bad government, you are going to end up in prison or repressed by the security forces of the states. At the moment, the way to govern Cuba is disastrous. Why? Because the government tries to maintain a style of power, a concentration of power that only benefits the government itself, but does not benefit the majority. This is seen, for example, in the decrease of what is called the disappearance of the basket. For example, the basket in Cuba is mandatory.
Para toda la población y desde hace 4 años hacia acá ha ido desapareciendo en las llamadas bodegas cubanas.
This amount of fruit is sold to the entire population. From 4 years ago until now, they have disappeared. The so-called Cuban wineries, there is no rice, there is no sugar, there is no coffee, there is no beans. The quota of bread is significantly reduced. They only give a portion of bread per person of approximately 50 grams. 50 grams is a very small amount of bread. So the Cuban population looks very limited. Poverty has grown exponentially.
In Cuba, it is a little more difficult to gain access to journalists and academics than in other countries that would comment on this subject of the downsides of the state of Cuba. But I was successful in contacting a very high-profile journalist with access to a Canadian journalist. Luis Toledo Sandy is a Cuban writer, researcher, and journalist with a PhD in philological sciences from the University of Havana, author of several books of different genres. He has taught at the university and has been director of the Marti Studies and deputy director of the magazine Casa de las Americas. In diplomacy, he has served as cultural counselor of the Cuban embassy in Spain. Among other recognitions, he has received the Distinction for National Culture and the Social Sciences Critics Award. He spoke to me first about the Obama administration's normalization approach to Cuba as articulated earlier. We'll be back with our exclusive interview, but just a reminder, you are listening to a special program on Cuba on May Day 2025 on the Global Research News Hour, a program funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. My name is Michael Welch, and here now is Luis Toledo Sande.
Bueno, fue uno de los 10 años más complejos quizás de la historia de Cuba, porque por un lado ya se había desmontado antes.
This has been the last 10 most complex years for Cuba. Because on the one hand, the socialist camp and the Soviet Union, which was to a large extent the commercial support of the Cuban Revolution, had already been dismantled, and capitalism has festered in the world which has to do with the tightening of a blockade that has lasted more than 60 years. But in recent years, especially after Trump's first term in office, it has worsened with very strong measures against Cuba. We have to start because Cuba had and has a great need, and it would be fair to lift the blockade. Therefore, that necessarily raises hope in Cuba when talking about the possibility of lifting the blockade.
Dos o tres días o cuatro días después, por ahí, de las declaraciones de Obama y Raúl Castro, yo escribí un artículo titulado...
Two or three days after Obama's and Raúl Castro's statements, I wrote an article entitled The United States, Another Stage, which is published in Cuba Debate. In that December 2014, warning about the fact that we should not have any unrestricted hope, nor expect any kindness from the empire, not hope. If in Cuba someone had or we had any inordinate hope on that fact, it was our responsibility and also that fact of having hopes. But Obama himself said that he was trying to do by other means what the blockade had not achieved. Because according to Obama, with all his imperialism cynicism, the blockade had not achieved what he was looking for. If, with all the damage that the blockade had done to Cuba, it had not achieved what it sought, it was clear that what Obama wanted was to crush us completely, and the blockade had not achieved that. If we did not know how to read that, if someone did not know how to read that, is the responsibility of those who did not know how to read Obama's message, because there was a lot of hope. I remember some readers who said that we wanted to buy the hand that came to give us food, something that is already a total aberration of thought. Moreover, Obama acknowledges that the blockade was isolating the U.S. more than Cuba. Isolating it from what? From a continent like our America and the Caribbean, where there was a progressive heyday, let's say progressive to understand, which was contrary to U.S., and that heyday the situation in Cuba was very well understood and Cuba was supported. Therefore, ways had to be sought to ensure that the U.S. was not left aside. They still consider that Latin America has to be their area of influence, and if the blockade weakened that area of influence, they had to change their policy.
After 2014, just 3 months after, Obama said that he launched murderous sanctions against Venezuela for the national security of the United States. And I'm wondering if that kind of off path, does it ruin the truce that's being established in this normalization or thaw process?
Fuimos también muchos, seguramente los cubanos y las cubanas, que entendimos ese juego.
There were also many of us, certainly the Cubans, who understood that this was Obama's game. We understood it. And we were not alone, to name a good company that those of us who thought that, it is enough to name Fidel Castro, who was always clear about what the empire was looking for. He was clear since December 2014. He was clear when Obama visited Cuba in 2016. And he published When Obama Left, Brother Obama, with all the ironic charge that the word brother has at that time. Those of us who I think were clear about what was happening had Fidel Castro as a companion. Although we did not know it, we sensed it. Obama, on the other hand, is not an isolated case. Obama must be placed in a tradition of evil and goodness, in quotation marks, which come from long before with Roosevelt's good neighbor policy, which later had in Kennedy the same one who had authorized the invasion of Bay of Pigs, had in Kennedy a continuity and came to have in Obama the closing of a perverse, fearful, and cunning trio. I believe that Obama must be placed in that tradition. And it is not a case of a self-made man as a politician. He has his cunning, he has his intelligence, an intelligent and sinister man, but he's also the fruit of the tactics of a system which was already the good neighbor policy of Roosevelt, the alliances for progress in quotation marks of Kennedy, and Obama comes to announce, to speak of a change of policy in particular, and at the same time he's given from the beginning to his of his presidency, he's given the Nobel Peace Prize, which serve him as a police, as a license to intensify the aggressive policy of the United States and to have against Africa the policy he had against Africa and to be one of the U.S. presidents associated with the greatest number of wars. I believe that this is not an isolated case.
So who wants to see and want to see can do it.
Bueno, yo creo que a Raúl Castro le tocaba el papel del dirigente político de Cuba.
Necesitaba que se levantara el bloqueo y con la responsabilidad de no decir ni hacer nada que parecía dirigida a frenar con una posible normalización. Tengamos en cuenta que una de las acusaciones que le hacen a Cuba los enemigos de la revolución cubana es que Cuba está interesada en mantener el bloqueo para justificar su bloqueo.
To justify its short problems. And Cuba showed that it's not interested in maintaining the blockade because it
even facilitated Obama's visit to Cuba. It gave him the option to express himself freely in a theater that is a topic for another conversation. But it was clear that Cuba was not interested in maintaining the blockade. It was not necessary to wait until 3 months later when Obama made the statements to know what Obama was saying about Venezuela. The fact is that Obama left Havana for Buenos Aires in Macri's Argentina to orchestrate the war against Venezuela.
It is of a sinister and evil kind. He tried to neutralize Cuba with the offer of a possible elimination of the blockade, with the promise of a possible normalization of relations. He tried to neutralize it so that Cuba would not continue protesting against the empire. Let us remember that Cuba was the main spearhead of a Latin American progressivism together with Venezuela. Let us remember that Venezuela was the natural replacement in the continent for Fidel Castro with Chavez. Let us remember that, and on the other hand, Venezuela was an important ally for Cuba. And on the other hand, to leave Havana when it's trying to neutralize Cuba for Argentina to orchestrate the political and economic war against Venezuela, which they are going to declare as a major danger that they are going to declare as a major danger to the security of the United States, was a very invisible maneuver by Obama for those who wanted to see it. The Cuban government saw that. It does not occur to me to think that the Cuban government did not see that. But a lot of people did not see that because they were in love with the idea that Obama came to Cuba to improve relations. I would like to make clear in translation the difference that we make between blockade, blood, and embargo. That's very important.
I'd like to talk about some articles you wrote in the past about Cubans, the greater set of Cubans who were wearing flags of the United States as shirts, and you even had photos of these flag shirts. Could you comment on the significance of this popular display?
Sí. Es un tema para preocuparnos.
It is a matter of concern. Yes. If tomorrow in the Catholic temple, in the honest religious temples, will begin to arrive faithful with the devil's t-shirts, I believe that the honest church should feel alarmed. I believe that Cuba should feel worried.
There is a lot of unpreparedness. There is a lot of ignorance of believing that is not important. A lot of cosmopolitanism in quotation mark. But I am sure that behind this there is a lot of influence to stimulate. Why in the containers that come to Cuba with clothes to sell, recycle or not,
Why so many shirts and shorts with the U.S. flag and shoes with the U.S. flag? There's not a coincidence, because the ideological outpost, the devil on the t-shirt of the faithful, is a way to break, unless the image has underneath it a devil war, down or die the devil. If you put on an image of devil, it is a way of breaking the religious faith. In the case of Cuba, this proliferation of flags can be a danger of cracking of ideological fissure, a feature of concept in the patriotic principles. We should know that the flag of the United States is not just another flag.
De fisura de concepto en la en la en los principios patrióticos y en la claridad con que debemos saber que la bandera de los
If tomorrow I find a Burundi flag and I like it and I wear it, but it's okay because Burundi is not attacking Cuba. The US is attacking Cuba and humanity. And how are the U.S. attacking Cuba? Maintaining the blockade and attacking Cuba. Let's think about which are the U.S. that now more visible have a war against the world, which is the secondary to the support they give to Zionist Israel that is massacring the people of Palestine. Curiously, the two governments that remain constant in voting against the UN resolution condemning the blockade of Cuba are the U.S. and Israel. This is a very clear alliance, and if we Cubans in Cuba are not capable of having that clarity, we may be in danger of having severe ideological confusion. I want to believe that those Cubans who walk around with the little flag are not even remotely the majority of Cubans, but they are very visible. You go inside Cuba to a conglomerate of 1,000 peoples who are not carrying any flag, and there are 3 people carrying the U.S. flag, and that is what you see. That is what attracts attention, because it is incongruent. It is what it is against, and they also know that this image is important, defend the importance of the image, that if we were not so, Donald Trump would not have put in his social networks, his social vines, this montage of him dressed as the Pope, because that is a way of telling the world that he can be the Pope of humanity. He already said it. I can be a good Pope because I want to be a good Pope. He already said the Pope of all religions, the dominator, the Caesar of the whole world, that mixture of that time when the Pope could be the head of the church, of the empire, and the one who decided and oriented the forces of the Crusades. That is what Donald Trump wanted to do.
You wrote an article, it was March 8th of this year, having to do with the 60th anniversary speech by Fidel Castro on November 17th, 2005, at the Aula Magna University of Havana. And you mentioned a lot of the things in there, but one thing you also mentioned that stuck out for me was the fact that there was corruption, that this is something that's recognized. And I was wondering if you could comment on whether his ideas are outdated, or is it potentially, you know, anticipating what might be coming, you know, 20 years later?
Bueno, yo no soy un oráculo, no soy un vidente, soy un lector.
Well, I am not an oracle, I am not a seer, but I am a reader, and I try to observe reality. Fidel was not an oracle either, but he was a man of great foresight, and was José Martí, to speak of another Cuban. And when he talks about corruption, I don't think he's talking about concrete cases of corruption that were already known, or were not known, or were supposed to be happening in Cuba. But he already had very clear information on his side about what had happened to socialism in Europe and in the Soviet Union. We always talk about Europe and the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was part of Asia and part of Europe. He already knew where the corruption and the estrangement between the government and the masses, between the party and the masses had led, which resulted in the dismantling of socialism. And therefore, it was already known that socialism was not irreversible, because it had become fashionable that socialism was irreversible. I always wonder, because in history nothing is irreversible, because everything can be reversed, and I also believe that it's a danger for politics to consider that a political project is irreversible, because what happened with the Titanic could happen, which was supposed to be invulnerable, and therefore the necessary rivets were not put on it. And it is a hypothesis, of course. Not enough lifeboats were put on the Titanic because it was invulnerable. No measures had to be taken. On the first crossing, the Titanic broke up and sank. If it had not been considered impregnable and more safety measures had been taken, probably either it would not have sunk or there would not have been so many deaths. But socialism was considered irreversible, and it was proven one day, even for those who knew that it's not irreversible, one day it was proven that it was not. The Soviet Union was dismembered, and the European socialist camp collapsed. That disintegrated and converted to capitalism, and without a shot. Well, the shots had happened before, but that happened in the end. And Fidel Castro, who was a man trying to save a country in progress, fears that this could happen in Cuba and warns against it. Not in the abstract. And he warns against it so much that he has learned from what had happened in Europe and in the Soviet Union. He says that our external enemies will not be able to destroy Cuba, but we ourselves could destroy it from within because of such great evils as a corruption. What Fidel said in 2005, 5 years after he gave the speech where he made public his concept of revolution, was no longer an abstract theory. It was the result of what had happened in countries more powerful than Cuba. If that was dismembered, we should assume that Cuba, with far fewer resources, would go through the same thing.
In that context, as well as the current difficulties in terms of high inflation and the income is that it's going down. I think Haiti is the only other country with a lower poverty than Cuba right now. I'm wondering. And also, there was a 2021. There was a major demonstration, maybe the biggest demonstration since the special period in the 1990s. Reflecting on the economic impoverishedness of the people and so on. I was wondering how you could evaluate the recent May 1st. Demonstration, is it in the way in Canada we tend to think of May 1st as an opportunity to push certain concerns. How would you evaluate the May Day with everything I've just had to say?
Well, we have low salaries. There are countries that do not have even salaries. That's an exaggeration, but there are countries that do not have even good salaries. I think that what explains May 1st is this year in Cuba, that is a really great death, because it means that the Cuban people who went there voluntarily, who were there with an attitude of festivity that went beyond what I expected. I expected to see support from the for the Cuban Revolution, but what I saw there left me moved. I was there with some friends from my building, and we were talking about it. These are people who really have a powerful intuition. While we were discussing, there was not whether or not to increase the quota of rights for the population. What was being discussed there was whether it was necessary for the revolution to survive, which had achieved for the Cuban people standards of living and standards of development in education, public health, science, and sports like never before. Or it was necessary to go there to demand a little more public transportation or to go there to condemn the blockade and imperialism, which are the forces that are keeping us without public transportation. And the Cuban people went there, and they went there with joy. No one was there, neither forced, nor punished, nor threatened. It is not possible to see such a festive, joyful atmosphere in the midst of the misfortunes of the world. It is not possible. That had a great impact. It had a great impact on the enemy. There is a little video of a montage of the devil with one of the fascist leaders from Germany with the general staff representing the U.S. Embassy in Cuba, saying that the information had deceived them because they had been told that nobody was going to go, that the Cuban Revolution continued to have significant mass support, which was the reason for the blockade, which was to leave the Cuban government without support. The memorandum of the U.S. agent who gave guidance on how to establish the blockade gave guidance that it was so that there would be hardship, so that salaries would not be sufficient, so that there would be hunger and that the people would rebel against the government because the government had massive majority support. And that May 1st showed that this blockade has not succeeded in making the Cuban people complain, that the Cuban people are frank, sincere, free, and say whatever they want, even if they protest afterwards, they know that in a sense where the causes of the hardships lie. And those causes are fundamentally without discounting or deficiencies, the corruption that may exist, without discounting the work of the opportunists that exist in any part of the world, the greatest effect of the Cuban hardships is in the hostility of the U.S. against Cuba, against the revolution, and against the Cuban people.
Because Cuba is such a unique country, and there are, you know, different complexities outsiders won't understand. I'm wondering if you could maybe explain your role as a journalist, as a revolutionary journalist. What are the principal characteristics of a journalist like yourself?
Bueno, yo creo que cada quien, ya sea como escritor o como periodista, que es mi caso, como profesor que he sido.
Well, I think that everyone, whether as a writer or as a journalist, professor or diplomat, as I was, the main role that one has in first of all is to be sincere, to be honest. You cannot help yourself, your family, if you are not sincere with your family, if you do not warn your family, if you do not recognize the virtues of your family and do not point out the mistakes and defects. So it is not a question of turning the intellectual into the conscience of fear of the humanity. No. Every citizen should always warn against wrongdoing, confront wrongdoing, suggest, if possible, ways to eradicate the wrongdoing. And if wrongdoing is not eradicated, it is not because he has not done what is necessary, what is within his reach of to rectify it. I believe that modestly, that is the role of each one of us, Above all, a human being is a human being. A human being must help his country to achieve and conquer the fruits it deserves, and if it does not conquer it, because the world does not favor it, it should not be because he has not put his shoulder first to all participate in the work, or furthermore, to warn what he has to warn. Is Cuba going to achieve what Cuba deserves to achieve? Well, it is not certain, because just as nothing is irreversible, nothing is fatally achievable, and besides, I'm not sure that there is a country in the world that has time to rebuild a social system before the world is destroyed. I don't want to be apocalyptic, actually, far from it, but the destruction of the world is a much less remote possibility now that it used to be. Not only because of the seas, not only because of climate change, which is one of the great dangers we have, there is a danger of war. What is happening in front of the world with the Palestinians who are being massacred day after day. And it may happen that in the midst of the destruction, U.S. President goes to the Gaza Strip to say that he would build his own resort there, his own hotel chain. It is a symbol of a moral shamelessness, but also the danger of the world destroying itself, thinking that the powerful are indestructible as well. Of course, if the world is destroyed and there are only 25 powerful people, what are they going to eat? A human being is above all a human being. Every human being, as the Greek classics already knew, is a political being, and that political being has to contribute to make the best policy for his people, whether he achieves it or not. That he does not achieve is not his responsibility. At least he has tried. And speaking more modestly, individual forces are small for all that is required to transform a country.
Understanding what Cuba's going through, anything else you'd like to say before we close the conversation?
Bueno, Cuba ha sido obligada por las circunstancias a hacer cambios, modificaciones que yo creo que son no leves en su modo de producción, en su sistema, en su manera de administrar la.
Cuba has been forced by circumstances to make changes in its mode of production and its way of administration, in the diversification of property, in the expansion of private property throughout the country, to make a series of changes that I would like to see all of them serve to truly improve the Cuban people, to lay the foundations of the Cuban nation and not become a Trojan horse for the Cuban nation. To be alert against this, it is a responsibility for all patriots and for all revolutionaries and for decent people. And I want to end by thinking that hope must be cultivated, hope that does not come and is not perceived from the air, but that we have to cultivate it, remembering a maxim of religious origin that says, to God begging and with a sledgehammer giving. If we do not work for this, for things to change, and change for the better, because Fidel Castro in his concept said to change everything that must has be changed, he did not say change everything, not change it badly or not change it irresponsibly. It is to change everything that should be changed. And on the eve of the Bay of Pigs invasion, it is a revolution of the humble, by the humble, and for the humble to achieve what José Martí called the human goal of well-being and decency.
That was our interview with Luis Toledo Sande. Many thanks to the translator, Sahili Amaro Cartea. That concludes this chapter. Part 2 resumes next week. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour, a show funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with CAMP's community radio station, CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, the Innu, the Ojibwe, the Dene, and the Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The show is available to radio stations across the United States and Canada, and it can be streamed or downloaded at globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. My name is Michael Welch. Thank you for listening. Take care.